It is needless to outline the beliefs and methods used in the Chinese, Japanese, South American, and other mysteries, because while the legends which are inculcated may vary in some way, they are all essentially and basically the same. The training hardly varies at all. The real mystery when man first discovered the use of certain procedures to condition other men and thus rule them and control them.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Jared Kushner trying to be in two places at once, straight from Tel Aviv to the Bilderberg dinner tomorrow night. So, the secret rulers of the world meeting in Montreux, Switzerland. Well, the secret rulers of the NATO countries anyway, right now. And the world only found out where the Bond Villains Convention was taking place on Tuesday morning this week. And by coincidence, the strongest Swiss earthquake for about the last 2 years, 4.2 on the Richter scale, hit at 10 to 11 in the morning just outside the city of Montreux. It says they're releasing their press release. Financial tsunami may hit the euro-dollar zone with global repercussions if Brexit happens on Halloween, as well as getting an illegal war started with Iran, which will hopefully drag in, if they have their way, all the main superpowers. It's my unofficial agenda of Bilderberg. Also, would you have the microchip from your contactless payment card implanted in your hand? What if it gave you a discount on all the transactions like petrol or daily train and bus fares? And then what would happen if you changed your mind? Could you get it out? We go back to Brent Scott. We'll hear a little bit from him as well. The Heretic's Guide to Global Finance is his book, Hacking the Future of Money. Sister Show Dialect is here on BCFM Tuesday at noon this week. Stephen Kinzer and Chris Mulligan, both historians in the post-war US deep state. They give their views on the rise of unaccountable government in the United States and a foreign policy that kills millions and makes the US a global reputation mud. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday or download it from dialectradio.co.uk right now. But I'm hoping I'm joined on the line by Charlie Skelton from Montreux. We'll try and get Charlie back. In the meantime, Martin, tell us about the Bilderbergs.
They've been meeting since in the post-war period. They originally met in the Bilderberg Hotel in Oosterbeek in near Arnhem. And basically, it's where NATO coordinates its policies, and the movers and shakers from big business and politics get together off the record and decide what they're going to do. Although I suspect, in actual fact, some of them are just told what to do. You can't really stop business people getting together to have a private meeting, but the politicians are supposedly our representatives, and they go along.
Can you hear us, Charlie?
I just heard that last bit, with which I agree.
Okay. Charlie, can you just take us through what's been happening since you arrived in Montreux?
Well, it's quite a light-touch policing this year around the Montreux Palace Hotel, which is surprising because we've got people like Jared Kushner there and Stoltenberg, head of NATO, and There's a lot of rumour that Pompeo is going to drop in order to discuss what have, you know, the things like what have they got on there? They have a stable strategic order and things like that. So it's a very pleasant experience so far because they spent a lot of money putting up security screens, and we, by pure chance, got invited in by a girl up to a third floor balcony which overlooked the entrance, so we got lovely clear pictures of everyone.
With Pompeo, this is a bit controversial if he's there, because everyone knows he's doing a world tour right now to try and get a war started with Iran. And it was actually the host, wasn't it, that said that Pompeo was going to be there. And maybe it's possible that he leaked that out without when he wasn't supposed to, because Pompeo is not on the official list.
I think it was a mistake, and I think he did say it, because I don't understand why it would appear in the articles unless he mentioned it in the chat. Because it would be too weird to just suddenly have the name Pompeo appear. So yeah, I think it was a mistake.
What about some of the main topics then? I mean, we've got a list of them. I would say, for example, there's quite a lot of the ethics of artificial intelligence. This is one that could be applying to some of the... I mean, I wonder who you think will be giving those seminars and what's that about?
Well, Nick Bostrom, I guess, will be giving that one. The guy from Oxford is the AI expert who does the rounds of these kinds of conferences. But it's all very mixed up at the moment because, you know, AI and the military and social media, they're all sort of one becoming one thing. It's sort of becoming integrated around technology. So it's really difficult to pull them apart. So, you know, because social media is becoming militarized, that's one of their, you know, topics of conversation. And there's lots of AI investors and experts, and so it's a real mix, but all moving further and further towards tech all the time.
Quite a lot of military there as well.
There's two people from the Pentagon, two officials. There's a guy, James H. Baker, who is he's the Pentagon's top sort of war gamer. He's the director of the Office of Net Assessment, so he's the guy who works out how many bombs need to drop on how many people and for how much, you know, money, etc. He's a sort of actuary of war. And and you've also got a guy who is the technical director of their AI, the Pentagon's AI unit. So, you know, the Pentagon are there, the White House is there. They've got two members of Trump's National Security Council there. So it's very, you know, America is very heavily present here this year, never mind obviously all of the, you know, the Silicon Valley people who, all of the Silicon Valley lot have, you know, one hat, one foot in the Pentagon. You know, whether it's Palantir or, you know, Eric Schmidt, who's heads up the Pentagon's Defense Innovation Board and also chairs their new AI board. So everything, as I said, it's all blurry
I mean, hang on, because Eric Schmidt, he was the chief, Google chief. It seems to me, yeah. Google is now openly, since he is migrating from Google to the military. I mean, there's been this connection with Matthew Cutts years ago from the National Security Agency, who was one of their chief engineer designer guys. This link between Google and the military seems to be coming out into the open.
Well, it's not. It definitely is, and it's not just Google. I mean, it's all of them. Microsoft have got huge Pentagon contracts. So is Palantir has just got, which is Alex Karp is the CEO. He's there, and it was set up by Peter Thiel, they're both on the Bilderberg Steering Committee, and that was set up with CIA backing through InQtel, which is their Silicon Valley sort of venture capital arm. And all of them are taking Pentagon contracts, not just Google, it's all of them now.
So weaponization of social media, I did strike me as quite amusing that Bilderberg should put this as a serious topic for discussion, because really social media is their baby. I mean, you know, this Peter Thiel you just mentioned, I mean, he was one of the main original founders of Facebook, obviously someone that's gained a lot from it, but social media surely is theirs.
Well, absolutely. I was just talking about this. It's what's odd about it is that if you think about where Bilderberg began, it began a lot of it from psychological warfare people from the Second World War, and it's all about, you know, it began with a lot of propagandists involved. And it sort of went back again to that point of a kind of pre-war propaganda-led Bilderberg. So they're talking a lot about, you know, so that's why you've got this NATO, the head of NATO's Strategic Communications Unit, STRATCOM, Center of Excellence, which is a brilliant name, which is basically their sort of PSYOPs unit, and also the head of GCHQ. So these are the people that sort of have got their fingers in all of the digital pies and are worrying about social media and how to control it, how to control the message, because, you know, controlling the message is a military strategic issue now. It's not just, oh, don't let make people swear at each other. You know, it's because the warfare has become digitalised.
Well, it's also, I mean, I think now the mass media is becoming, not all mass media, thank God, but some, most of it seems to be becoming like the spearhead for the war machine. So if you want to go in and invade a country, whether it's illegal or whatever, then you need to have your mass media on side to make that case for the, even for just a few days or maybe weeks, the initial part of the war, just to carry people along with it, Charlie.
Well, that's interesting, because you've also got that's the other sort of angle of Bilderberg's sphere of influence that it's got, is through the media. So you've got quite a lot of commentators there. If you look down, you've got people from different countries who are sort of news anchors, and, you know, like Charlie Rose used to go a couple of times, that kind of person. You know, there's people like Lily Gruber from Italy, you know, Martin Wolf from the FT, and there's quite a lot of journalists there, really. There's more journalists inside than there are outside this year, which is sad, but that is the case. And also, obviously, media owners and, you know, newspaper moguls. Big, huge ones. So yeah, controlling the message has to be take place in the media, and they're all here. The whole thing is weaponized.
Going back to Baker and the wargaming, I mean, this... with you combine this with artificial intelligence and Mike Pompeo, and you really have got a bit of a toxic mix there, because if you start thinking about the way wargaming is going into electronic wargaming, and then also you start bringing in AI. So, you know, we started many years ago, didn't we, with the old chess computers people would fight against, but now they're starting to bring all this into wargaming. So they say, well, if we do this and we do this, maybe we can win this war. Now, this sounds to me like quite a dodgy, dangerous area that a lot of money can be spent by the military-industrial complex on this without actually firing a shot, but it gives them the confidence to think they can get away with starting another Iraq, potentially.
So you mean they're getting sort of tricked into being overconfident by their own algorithms?
Well, I suppose they'll be playing these games again and again, and then they say, oh, suddenly we won. And possibly, if the algorithm is a bit faulty, they'll be tricked into thinking exactly what you just said, Charlie.
Although, you know, haven't they watched Doctor Strangelove? it probably won't end well, that kind of strategy. Yeah, you think?
I suppose it's a way of spending money without actually necessarily fighting wars, although, of course, they're doing that quite a lot of the time. Many of the people involved in this war fighting there. Now, you also had a chat, I think, with some Swiss yellow vests. Now, was that about two or three of them, or was there a few more? Because I didn't realise that the whole yellow vest movement... I suppose this is French Switzerland, isn't it?
Yeah, so there were about a dozen of them down there, and they're coming back in bigger numbers tomorrow at 9 o'clock. That's what they say, and they were very nice. They were just there in their, you know, bright jerkins, sort of bearing witness to the establishment doing its thing, and they said they just wanted to be seen and heard and to show that their sort of disapproval.
How would you describe the Bilderbergers? What are they really all about?
I don't know. I don't think you can describe. I think you can't describe them as a unit. I think you can say that there are certain sort of circles of power in it. I think you can say that they are as a unit is a sort of a very interesting blurring of power and money and influence, but it's very difficult to make general statements about it. That's what I find. It's easy to pick people out and go, oh look, we can see their influence and they do this and that. But as a group, it's a It's an odd thing. I'm sorry, I don't know what to say that is enlightening, apart from it's a thing worth studying because it's endlessly interesting.
How about the how to keep our wealth and avoid any tax or contributing anything to society whilst expanding our empire club?
That's a bit, well, I like that. They're discussing the future of capitalism, which is such an odd thing. You've got the future of capitalism being discussed by like the chairman and CEO of Goldman Sachs International and the chairman of HSBC. What are they going to say? I don't know. You've got the heads of like BP and Total and discussing climate change and sustainability. It's all very odd.
Martin Summers, what is the future of capitalism? What would be your contribution at the Bilderberg workshop there?
Well, I've just read two very interesting books about the future of capitalism, one by Paul Mason and another one by somebody I've forgotten the name of, basically saying that what seems to be happening is that capitalism basically died in 2008. It's still dead. It's not recovered. But we haven't really got an alternative. So this is the real problem, is that capitalism is basically dying in front of us. And, of course, we used to believe in the 19th century that something better would evolve from this, socialism or something of the sort, whereas it's quite possible we're just going to end up in a chaos situation where capitalism doesn't work anymore and there's nothing else to replace it with. I'm not trying to be too negative, because we've got to try and find ways to deal with the situation we're in, but I think they know as I know that ultimately, I mean, the right-wing economists and left-wing economists are all pretty clear that this bubble's going to burst, and when it bursts we're not going to be bailing the banks out because there's no money, because it's all been spent already. And at that point, what we're really talking about is what do the Russian general staff think? What do the Chinese general staff think? What do the NATO general staff think? What do the Israeli general staff think? The Iranian general staff? We're moving closer and closer to a simultaneous crash and world war. And of course, what happened in World War II was you had a crash, and it fed, because the system was so much less integrated, it took quite a long time before the war broke out. But we're probably going to get both things simultaneously, and it may well happen in the autumn. And I'm not looking forward to it, frankly.
Well, I don't know what Henry Kissinger would say in reply to that, Martin. I'm not quite sure. But Charlie, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who was the co-founder of Bilderberg, former SS officer, and also he had to resign in disgrace after the Lockheed scandal, he said, he co-founded the group, he said that severe economic dips like the Great Depression could be avoided if responsible individual leaders could manage world events behind their necessarily public posturing. The idea was for a big talking shop attended by the great and the good, where the mistakes of the past could be learned and the problems of the future avoided. So really they're saying it's actually a very good off-the-record opportunity to have a chat about these things, Charlie.
Well, picking up that and what Martin was saying, and also your question about what is Bilderberg, isn't that exactly what they're sort of still doing? It is to say, here we are, this is a system, a way of doing politics, a way of doing governance that isn't the old traditional way of doing it. It's here we are, we are behind closed doors, we are sorting out all these, the major issues of the day, as they say. And, politics is dead. Clearly, look at Britain. Look at everything. Politics is over. Forget capitalism. That's over. We can manage the whole thing in our kind of technocratic, small framed, powerful elite body where we just have discussions and sort everything out. We're the experts. We can get around a table and thrash it out. Don't you worry. And then we'll sort of see how the whole thing can be managed. So possibly that they see themselves as a sort of post-capitalist, post-political, technocratic force.
Also, I mean, maybe you could just run through some of the other British participants. It's interesting to see John Saws there again. It doesn't say on the list that he used to be the Director General of MI6, and of course he was one of the people in charge when the whole Syrian big inverted commas civil war kicked off.
Oh, sorry, that was me.
Yeah, I mean, what do you make of some of the... it's just interesting to see him there. He's now a sort of private consultant, but he was one of the people who was responsible for the I mean, it was definitely the CIA and MI6 were involved in starting the Syrian civil war. And here he is sitting around the table with everyone talking about how to put the world to rights. I mean, I look at lists of people like this and I think, well, this is actually the people who've put the world to wrong, not right.
Well, he's done what Soyuz has done, the thing of, you know, he's now on the board of BP. He's a director of BP. He's done the classic Kissinger thing, which is to leave, you know, the head of an intelligence service, and he's done what Petraeus has done. Petraeus has left the CIA and is now he regularly attends Bilderberg, and he's now at KKR, the head of their whatever they call it, Global Investment Unit or something. And you get a real blast of the air from the revolving doors.
I mean, is it as simple as when I was at MI6, I managed to start various civil wars that got the big oil companies a whole load of oil fields, and now they're giving me a job?
Well, possibly. I mean, we had photographs of John Sawyer's talking to the chairman, the then chairman of BP, in Copenhagen, and having long chats on the veranda, just the two of them. And this was just before he'd left office at MI6. So he was set sorting out, you could actually see him sorting out his next job. It was very odd. And then, he left MI6 and then joined BP.
Now, you briefly mentioned DeepMind, Palantir, these kinds of firms. This whole business of data mining is incredibly powerful, potentially, where whole massive dossiers of information are collected on every single person on the planet, and that is then used to decide things like your insurance policies, etc., etc. What do you make of these companies like Palantir? They seem a bit... I mean, he's taken, obviously, on the Tolkien name there, but what are these guys really up to, DeepMind and Palantir?
Well, it's interesting. They're run by people because they're sort of this new. They're a bit younger, techie people. They're not how you might imagine the leader of a shady organisation might be. So you've got people like Alex Karp. He's did a doctorate in German philosophy, and he does yoga and various kind of martial arts, and he's all a bit new agey in a weird way, and he calls himself a socialist, but yet he runs this, you know, massive company which gets Pentagon contracts and does basically it's there to do things like sort of to stop whistleblowers and things like that, because it, the technology can see people's patterns of behaviour, so he knows you're going to whistleblow before you do. Things like that. You know, that's a lot of these companies. That's all. I remember Eric Schmidt saying about Google that their aim is to get to answer the question that you have before you ask it, before you even know you want it. So it's getting to this whole thing about data mining is all about getting to know people far better than they know themselves.
Well, of course, on a basic level, on a really basic level, Charlie, of course, they're tracking a lot of what you're doing. I mean, tracking you, your location, and obviously, you know, I can't remember where I was exactly a year ago today, but they know where I was. They'll be all on their data set. Anyway, what about Brexit? Because that's on the list, of course. Not many pro-Brexiteers there. No Boris, apparently, but Lord Adonis is there, who's very much pro-Brussels. You'd be a fly on the wall in there. What do you think they'd be talking about with regard to the Brits?
Well, a couple of years ago, I spoke to a very senior former member of the official at the European Commission. I asked her this is the time of the Greek meltdown, and I said, what would happen if Greece left the EU? And she said, it wouldn't really matter. And I said, what would happen if Brexit happened, if Britain left the EU? And she said, it would be catastrophic. And so, you know, I think that as you saw around the time of Brexit, the Bilderbergers, they came out, and they actually emerged a little bit from their usual shadows to hold meetings, make statements. They were actually out lobbying against Brexit. They really were. It was quite funny to see. And I think obviously they're deeply pro-European. It's built into the very fibre of Bilderberg. And so Brexit is a massive crisis for them. So yeah, Brexit for them is a big problem.
What about intimidation of journalists? I understand that some were arrested and put in a cell at Geneva Airport for filming and talking to the Bilderbergers as they were arriving. And I wonder if you've had any problems yourself.
I have not, I have to say. Apart from finding a lovely spot to photograph the front door and then they literally had a conversation and brought in a truckload of massive pot plants, like potted trees, and shifted them in front of us. But that was very annoying, but that was just before we got our invitation onto the third floor balcony, so it all ended well. So I haven't had any trouble with them at all, to be honest.
What about the others?
Oh, well, I haven't actually spoken to them since. I've been locked away, but not locked away in that sense. I've just been writing and doing photographs, but I haven't spoken to them. But I did see a photograph of them in some sort of detention room. I wouldn't call it a cell, but I think they were fine.
What about Switzerland itself? I mean, many of us have never been to Switzerland. It's a little bit... you do think, like, sometimes a bit like Conspiracy Central. Everything is very... squeaky clean, but there's something missing. It's a bit two dimensional. I wonder, because they also they have had an amazing escape from the world wars that have raged around them. But what do you make of the Swiss government?
And
the Swiss police, the whole situation. I mean, is it expensive? I would imagine Switzerland pretty expensive.
Oh my god, it's expensive. I went to the garage to buy some snacks, and it cost me £45. Someone I know had a starter Caesar salad, and that cost £45. I think everything here costs £45.
Get yourself a car, then.
I can't afford it. I have to get a mortgage to get a car here.
Okay. Anyway, Charlie, I just wonder if there's anything else you'd like to relate about, this year's experience and the guest list, a final sort of, what you'd like to tell us about the Bilderbergers?
Well, really, just Kushner being here is very interesting. It's, you know, to have Donald Trump, who came to power promising a clean-up of the swamp, to have his son-in-law swimming around in it,
Well, he's coming straight from Tel Aviv, isn't he? I think tomorrow, as I understand it, the Washington Post had two stories. One was saying that Kushner was at Bilderberg, and the other one saying he was in Tel Aviv negotiating with Netanyahu. So I imagine he'll be hot foot from Tel Aviv tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, that'll be fun. We'll listen out for the motorcade.
Do you want to... Who is he?
Kushner?
Yes, who is he? I know he's the President Trump's son-in-law, but why is he important? Why are people be interested in him?
Apparently, he's got the office closest to Donald Trump's, the Oval Office. So that's he's turning himself into a bit of a gatekeeper and holder of the reins of power, because obviously Trump isn't really anything. So so he's a very powerful man. I don't quite know what will happen post Trump, if there is a world post Trump, and whether he'll manage to leverage this whole thing into actual sort of political longevity. That would be interesting to see him, become something more than just this blip. But yeah, I don't know. I don't. When I play tennis with him, he's really nice and just relaxed.
Listen, Charlie, you're not in the Guardian. Why not? I mean, what's happened with the Guardian? Have you asked them this year, or have you snubbed them?
No, I can't comment.
Oh, really?
I can't comment at this time. Let's just put it that way.
Okay, well, good luck with them. Anyway, Charlie Skelton from Montreux. We won't give away your location. You're squirreled away in a hotel. And thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show. And the very, very best of British luck to you.
Thanks very much. And best to you too as well.
Cheers, Charlie. Well, Martin, what do you make of what's going on over there?
Well, I mean, Kushner is not really a political insider. He was basically a property developer in New York when he married Ivanka. But he's basically become a foreign policy person. I mean, he basically is deciding foreign policy, even though he's got no background in it whatsoever, apart from the fact that he's Trump's son-in-law. So there you are. You know, he's come from nowhere to be an extremely powerful person with the ear of the president. He's very friendly with Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. He's very close to Netanyahu, and you know, he's an extremely interesting person because he's running around basically coordinating policy.
Well, what's your best guess? What would Kushner be saying tomorrow evening at the big dinner at Bilderberg if he's come straight from Tel Aviv?
Well, it's pretty clear. Kushner is in the loop with Pompeo and all the others. They want a war with Iran. And, of course, Boris Johnson is going to have to decide, because Trump's coming next week, and Trump's going to say, we're going to go with Iran, Boris. Are you up for it? And Boris will go, blah, 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 blah. Because, of course, the British people basically are not up for it. They're definitely not up for a war with Iran. And I don't suppose majority of the people in America are up for it either. But that's where we're going, bonkers as it may seem.
Well, we're joined on the line, I hope, by Manfred Petrisch. Can you hear us, Manfred?
Yes, I can.
Okay, Manfred, I know you're from Switzerland originally. Or actually not born in Switzerland, but you spent a lot of time there. Can you give us your take on this year's Bilderberg meeting in Montreux, please?
Yes, what we have noticed is that the Bilderbergers are more secretive than ever after, in the last years, they opened up more. So obviously they have been told to shut up and not tell anything, and that's the reason also why it was announced on such a short notice, and no information was leaked out weeks and months before, like in the years before. And we saw this also when they arrived at the airport in Geneva. And they didn't even say, when asked to give a comment, they didn't even say no comment. They just didn't say anything. So it seems that they have really been told not to say anything. And this means that they are going back to their old attitude, you know, of secrecy.
What, in your view, what is Bilderberg for? What's it all about?
Well, it is, you know, if you look at the people who attend there, they are the most richest, most powerful and most influential people in business, in banking, in the media, also you know, in the think tanks, and in politics. So it's very suspicious that they all meet together and spend four days. I mean, I had a look, you know, I've been watching the Bilderbergers since 2004, when they met in Stresa in Italy. And at that time, we were only about four or five people watching them, and there was hardly any security. And then when we, via the internet, because of the internet, we were able to put their faces on online, and we proved that they that Bilderberg actually exists, because up to that time, the media was saying, you are a conspiracy theorist, there is no such thing as Bilderberg.
Well, I can tell you, when we were covering it, Manfred, in 2000, the Bilderbergers themselves put out a story that it was a international croquet tournament and not Bilderberg at all. In the local newspaper, that's what they printed, that this is a croquet tournament and Bilderberg is just a rumour.
Right. Now, because we were able to photograph their faces and put them online, we proved that actually people are there and who is there. And then they had to change their attitude. And what they did was they built up the security. And later on, the years following, we were arrested and our cameras were taken away and we had to delete photos. And and also what happened was that the distance between us and them was increased steadily. For instance, in Austria, we were about 8 kilometers away from the hotel. They closed all the roads around it, and things like that. So it's amazing. And what's amazing is that they call themselves a private event, but the taxpayer has to pay the security. That means all the police that guard this them for 4 days on 24 hours. You know, there are hundreds of police who secure, and it's a private event, and that's why they say journalists, you know, you have no business here.
But I know
the taxpayer pays the security.
On your blog, you're saying this year that you did a post, Bilderberg is a fascist organisation. Now, that's a big accusation to make. This is just a bunch of businessmen meeting, surely?
Yes, but you have to see the whole history of the Bilderbergers, who founded them. And that was Prince Bernhard. And he was, before he married into the Dutch royal family, you know, during the 30s and 40s, he was a member of the NSDAP, the Nazi party. He was a member of the SS. He was a member of the SR. So he was 100% Nazi. And he is the founder of the Bilderbergers, and he was their president up to his death in 2004. So definitely the Bilderbergers have Nazi roots. And if you look what they are after, I mean, this is fascist ideology, definitely.
Okay, so what are they after? What do you think they're after?
Well, you see, because of all the major corporations that are there, you know, they are huge global corporations. What they are, and they float above governments. You know, they are so big. They're bigger than countries, and they're bigger than governments. They want a world where they can rule and make the rules, and everything is just for corporations. And you see this also in the European Union. I mean, the European Union is not made for the people, it's made for the corporations. They benefit from everything, and they want to expand it to a global scene. They want to have one global union and run everything in the interest of the big corporations.
But, I mean, surely the Chinese are going to have something to say about that. There's no Chinese actually at the Bilderberg, are there? This is only the NATO countries.
Well, that's the whole point also, this to always keep the bridge, the so-called transatlantic bridge, open between North America and Europe, and the whole thing is based, of course, on NATO. So you will never see Russians there, and you will never see Chinese there, and Asians anyway. So it's a European North American union there, and they work for this.
Now, you spent a long time in Switzerland. Do you think it's? I mean, you talked about this as a home game. For you, but I mean, surely that Switzerland is a place that Bilderberg feels quite content and happy. It's run by financial people most of the time, Switzerland, and also it seems to be immune to the world wars that have raged around them.
Well, that's in the past. That was 70 years ago. The problem that Switzerland has turned into is that it's also run by big corporations. You see, there are very big corporations in Switzerland which are way too big for this small country. I'll give you an example. Nestle, global company. Also, all the pharmaceutical companies, Novartis and everything, they are huge. And also the banks, they are huge. They are way too big for this tiny country. So they are all globalists. And the problem is that Switzerland has been completely taken over by globalists. And that's why they feel so, you know, feel themselves so well in this country. And that's why they meet there.
What about the city of Montreux? I imagine you know it. What sort of city is it? It's quite close to Geneva, and it's close to the United Nations. So why have we got only one person from UNESCO there? I wonder if the Bilderbergers think themselves as a bit of a competition for the UN in Geneva at the other end of the lake.
Well, in Geneva are more the humanitarian UN agencies, not the political ones. And like UNESCO, they're in Geneva. And, you know, the United Nations has actually lost completely its role. I mean, they have nothing to say on the world stage. You know, this is gone. You know, the corporations, they dictate, they make the laws, they tell the politicians what to do, and they also decide who gets into government. And they finance the elections and all these things, right? I mean, I saw this in St. Moritz, where Daniel Vazella, who was the head of Novartis, he actually sponsored the police there and gave them his private helicopter. So I mean, there I saw how they control everything, the big corporations. And you see it here, for instance, Eric Schmidt, who is the head of Google. I mean, these are huge, powerful people, right? And they are there, and they're all billionaires. I mean, you know?
Is Pompeo going to be there? I mean, he was announced, wasn't he? It was almost like a leak that Pompeo is coming, because he's not there.
Yes, he's coming, but because today he was in Berlin, and that's just a short hop from Berlin over to Switzerland, and he's going to meet the foreign minister of Switzerland. I don't know if he's going to Bilderberg, but he's definitely coming to Switzerland to meet representatives of the Swiss government. But who is definitely coming to Bilderberg is Jared Kushner. He's in Israel, and he will arrive tomorrow morning in Geneva and go to Bilderberg tomorrow morning.
So, I would suggest Pompeo probably will be there, because it was a leak on that first article that you picked up on so originally. Maybe the person wasn't supposed to say that he was going, and he didn't realise he wasn't supposed to say, because he's not on the official list. But what does this mean if Kushner and Pompeo are there too? Because these are both people with very strong war agendas.
Yes, you see, what happens at Bilderberg is that you have all these meetings and you have all these presentations of the 10 different topics that they discuss. And then, although they say no decisions are made, there are decisions made. And these decisions are then passed on to the attendees, and they go back home and then execute these things, like the big media bosses then sell the war. I mean, if they decide on a war, the big media bosses go home, and then their media will then sell the war, for instance. And the politicians go home, and they sell the war, or whatever they decide. I mean, this is they get their homework, you know, and then they go home and do it. That's what that's what Bilderbergers are there for. The same thing happened back in the 50s when they decided to create the EU and the European common currency. This was decided, and then after that, the execution followed in different steps over the years. Right.
One of the things they're discussing, Manfred, is the weaponization of social media. What do you think they're talking about?
Well, I think the classic example happened now in Germany. There is just a few days before the EU election, a young boy made a video where he denounced the CDU and the SPD party, the who formed the coalition, and he said that they are no good and you shouldn't vote for them. And we have, in the meantime, after doing a lot of research, found out that behind this young man, who got millions of clicks on this YouTube video, which definitely influenced the EU election, and that's why the coalition parties got such a bad result. He was actually, this was an advertising campaign by a huge PR company. So this is what I mean by weaponizing the internet. These big media companies and public relations companies use people, in this case a young man, and he looks like he's just an innocent guy who just made a video, but actually behind them is a huge powerful force. And this is being done all the time now to influence people in some direction that they want, political direction, how to influence elections and all these things.
Now you're
that's weaponizing the internet.
But it's their internet. A lot of these social media companies are Bilderberg companies. Peter Thiel funded Facebook, and LinkedIn are in there. Google are there.
Yeah.
Facebook, we've got Twitter, regular Bilderberg attendees, Jeff Bezos at Amazon. They're all there.
Yes, yes. Well, they profit, of course, through the advertising. You know, the ads that run in all those medias. I mean, the more people click and look at all these things, the more advertising revenue they get. I mean, they want to, of course, have popular things where a lot of people look at and read and watch, and then they can publish all their advertising and earn money with them.
So are these people more powerful than the politicians? What's happening to politics? Because it seems that big business is taking over.
Well, definitely, I would say, of all the people, of the 130 attendees, I think Eric Schmidt is definitely the most powerful person, because he runs Google and YouTube. And that means he can. You see, what I've noticed, for instance, that Google definitely changes the search results. That means they can decide when you search something, which results are on top and which are on the bottom, and which don't appear at all.
Well, to be fair to Eric Schmidt, he's now working with the Pentagon, not officially with Google anymore, but he is the Google founder. And also, what do you make of Montreux? Was it a city that...
Just a minute. He's the chairman of Alphabet, and Alphabet is the owner of Google, Google owns YouTube. Okay. So he's right at the top of those.
Okay, what about Montreux as a city? Have you been there?
Yeah, sure. It's a beautiful city on Lake Geneva, the Lake Geneva is beautiful, and the surrounding mountains are beautiful. And anyway, for instance, the singer of Queen, he had a house there. What's his name? You know the.
Your website, I'll just give it a plug, is All Smoke and Mirrors, Alice Schout and Roush. I'll put a link up to it on our show page.
Yeah.
But thank you very much, Manfred Petrich, for joining us.
Yes, I have about 10 or 20 articles where I show all the photographs we have made of all the people who are attending. So we've got a big gallery of all their faces in the meantime that we could shoot with our lenses. So if you visit my blog, you will see them all who are there. And tomorrow we will try also to get Kushner when he arrives.
Manfred Petrich, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Well, this course is Smoke on the Water, which is all about a whole load of events at a big hotel in Montreux. A little musical interlude. As far as I know, the hotel is not burning down.
right now. A little bit flippant there, playing Deep Purple from 1972 from Made in Japan album, Martin, but actually it's a little bit like this is a bit of, they're cooking up a war here in this meeting on Montreux.
They may well be doing exactly that, Tony. They won't just be doing that, they'll be doing other things as well, but they've certainly, they've made their position pretty clear. The Israelis and Kushner and Pompeo, they want a war with Iran, so does John Bolton. They're making no secret of it. They want to overthrow the government of Venezuela, and they basically want to have a trade war and possibly a shooting war with the Chinese and the Russians.
I mean,
absolutely bonkers.
I mean, this is the reporting of Jim Tucker from the American Free Press back in 2002, I think it was at Chantilly, the leaks coming literally from the bar staff were saying they're talking about a war with Iraq. And of course, in 2003, the rest is history.
Yes, well, that's right. That's the way these people, you know, if they're going to have a war, they discuss it first, and then they get the propaganda lined up, and then they do it, don't they? And we know they do. They've taken down Libya. What's it? General Wesley Clark said there were 7 countries that were going to be taken out in 7 years.
7 countries in 5 years.
7 countries in 5 years, wasn't it? But of course, in actual fact, they never managed to achieve all their goals. So they're behind schedule.
So what motivates these people?
Well, basically, the military-industrial complex in the West is its own justification. I mean, they're all making a packet out of it, and war is good business. It's so much easier if you get the government to buy your stuff than building a better widget to make the housewife's life better. That's a silly way to earn money. I was reading earlier that financial services now, they take the lion's share of profits, and of course, the military-industrial complex also takes the lion's share of profits, and that squeezes out people, you know, inventing new things to make people's lives better. Who wants to do that? There's much more money to be made from warfare.
Well, we were talking earlier on about fintech. We heard from Brett Scott. We're going to hear a bit more from him now about finance and technology and what happens when the two get together.
Most corporations, but financial corporations, are getting ever-increasing amounts of data about people. They're starting to be able to fine-tune profiles about people, and they're perfecting their methodologies for how you both understand people and then subsequently with that be able to manipulate them in various ways or present paths to them. If you were thinking about, like, you watch these science fiction films and you were wondering, like, how would we make this a reality? So something like Minority Report, for example. The way you would make it a reality is that you would integrate the financial sector with all the technology companies. You would basically make these seamless processes whereby, you know, you walk into a room and it triggers like some biometric thing by recognizing your face, and it automatically triggers a payment through the payment system of the banks, you know, or these kind of like automated exchange systems, which rely upon the banking sector to actually complete. Without that, there, you don't have those purely automated societies. So like that's like super long-term science fiction dystopia stuff, but that's actively what the financial sector is slowly working towards.
Brett Scott, Martin, this is all happening now, though, isn't it? Very slowly but surely. And no one's really getting a chance to decide whether they want to chip and pin or a contactless card. It's all just happening to us.
Well, on that particular note, Narendra Modi has won the election in India, sadly. And, of course, one of the things he did, which ought to have lost him the election, was to get rid of all large notes in cash. And, of course, in a country like India, that's disastrous for many small businesses.
OK, our final clip's going to be from Chris Mulligan. He's the author of Fleshing Out Skull and Bones. And he
here he talks about how he believes secret societies, and Skull and Bones is a very powerful one in the US, control the world.
Here's how the secret societies, quote-unquote, control the world. It's a leviathan of three levels. The top level is mining metal and money. It kind of makes sense. If you control the mining, where the metal comes from, that the money is supposed to be based on, you'd be in a good position. Then you have a central area where they do use war a lot, and that's drugs, guns, and oil. Okay, and, you know, we look at Skull and Bones, we look at Hong Kong, Shanghai Banking Corporation, the Mathesons. Opium became the largest commodity on the planet in the 1830s and has never left it. It creates huge, big slush funds, which allows them to control other industries. And then you have oil. In 1855, a gentleman from Skull and Bones, Dr. Benjamin Silliman Jr., made gasoline and paraffin for the very first time out of petroleum, out of rock oil. Then these secret societies have proceeded to monopolize things around oil. The only reason we go to the oil store is because they own it. There is many other ways of creating energy, but it's about control. And then where this leviathan meets the road, it's media. They have to control the media so they can control the dialogue. They can control the narrative. And then you have movies / music. They've got to control the culture or it'll bite them. And then you have quote-unquote magic, their ability to hoodwink us and their preponderance on using mass trauma rituals to keep us in line. At the end of the day, the Kennedy assassination was a ritual called the killing of the king. 9/11 was a mass ritual. Okay, you smash the archetypes and then you bring them back up the way that you want to. In the psychological warfare, it's like abortion, okay? The powers that be don't really give a fig about abortion, okay? But it is a gut issue, and they can use it to get people on opposite sides because they'd much rather have the population fighting each other about things than actually looking at how we're all getting, excuse my language, screwed.
Say time for sign-off for the US-owned Comcast News at 8. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us on the Politics Show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless and don't let the banksters get you down.
From the Sky News Centre.